Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about a few miscellaneous optimizations, like particularly with loops where we had redundant operations in the loops. We mentioned some cases where compilers might have a little trouble figuring out that they can take some common operation they're doing over and over again and do it just once. For example, if that's a function call, compilers usually can't figure out a function call always does the same thing without some help. And that it might also be nice to look at cases where, oh, we could divide a loop with a conditional into a, multiple loops with less conditionals, which will enable other optimizations. And it's one of the things we have you do in the smooth homework. Then we talked a bunch about vector or SIMD instructions. So this is where our processor would provide these registers, which could hold a small array of values and instructions that acted on that small array as an array. Typically, we do these pairwise operations. We take these two of these small arrays and we do an add or some other operation on every pair of values. And a typical implementation, not the only one, of these instructions, we would implement this by having an ALU that actually supported doing multiple adds or other operations at once. And we'd support accessing extra wide amounts of data from the data cache, or including for reads or writes, in order to support these instructions. So we'd have the same number of instructions, but each instruction would do a whole lot more work. We mentioned that for accessing this functionality, well, we could rely on our compiler's optimizer figuring that out. We mentioned that, sometimes that works really well, sometimes it doesn't. We could write assembly, and we have this kind of in-between option, where we had these C functions, which corresponded pretty directly to particular assembly instructions or sets of assembly instructions, which kind of gave us an in-between between going all the way to writing our code in assembly and writing everything in C and hoping the compiler figures out what we really want. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes? Sure. Quiz about question 6?
Yeah.
Okay. So question
6. Yeah, I was just confused with it, because the question didn't specify if the loop was already unrolled. And if the loop was already unrolled here, you just used like a vector instruction, wouldn't it do like the same amount of work faster?
So the question is, in this case, so you're talking about converting a function to use vector instructions on vectors of values. You're saying, couldn't the loop have already, couldn't the original function have already been unrolled? So I would say, would you expect it to be unrolled is sort of what the question's getting at, that like typically when we're writing the original loop, we wouldn't have unrolled it naturally. And if we had, if the philosophy is we're trying to optimize it, we probably should do the same things to the vector code, because the vectorized code will also benefit from unrolling.
Wouldn't you need to unroll for the vector?
So you need to do that transformation to be able to do the vectorization, but the vectorized code will benefit from additional unrolling for the same reason we wanted to unroll in the first place. That's going to be less indexing and so on. But I would say, like, the reason why I, said expect is that, if we're converting a function, a random function, you don't expect the random function to be written, such that it's unrolled the exact right number of times to make this work, right? That's not how you naturally write a function.
The one slide in the slide that it was like, had one loop with eight, adds.
Yes. So you're saying, we had this example where we vectorized, we had that unrolled loop. And that was not the first step of that, though. Right? We started with sort of the natural C code, which didn't have that unrolled yet.
Okay.
So it's true that we might want to unroll if we're not vectorizing, but it's not natural that we'd unroll the same amount that we need to vectorize.
Okay.
And in the same way. And I'd say that if we were unrolling without vectorizing, well, we were doing that because we were doing optimizations on our loops. And we can still do those optimizations on our loops in the vectorized version, too. And if it mattered on the original version, probably matters on the vectorized version. I agree, I maybe could have been clearer, but my intention of the question here was that we were starting with sort of the naturally written code, okay. Which, yeah, that you'd see in a normal program. Yes?
I have a question about question four.
Sure.
So for question four, for snippet B, is it essentially even, there's a possibility of loading a value at A, let's say the value of A is like 0, and then the value of the next pair of I plus 1 is like greater than 256 bytes, like maybe like 300. So therefore, it would be hard for the vector operation to load that specific value, and it's not possible at all.
So the question is the problem here that the values of AI for like A of 0 and A of 1 might not be adjacent?
Yeah.
Yes, and that's pretty likely if we're doing this. Yes, and that would indeed mean that we'd have to do something fancy to load those all into a vector like we'd want them. And with the instructions we talked about in lecture, there's not any good way of doing that. Yes? So if we were trying to vectorize snippet B, is there a way of doing that? So yes, there are, but it's with extra hardware support. So there is on sort of some vector instruction features on recent versions of Intel's extensions, and more commonly in more dedicated vector instruction processors, going back to the Cray 1 in the 90s, and also on GPUs that support doing that sort of, having a list of locations and loading them. That is obviously a lot more complicated to implement in the hardware, because we have to have one instruction which has like 8 or more cache accesses. So not all hardware will implement that, but commonly when people worry about vectorizing things like our snippet B, they're going to add support for those instructions. And that's going to be the typical way hardware will make that kind of efficient. And implementing those instructions efficiently is obviously a lot of work for the hardware designer. Yes? Yeah. So the question is, would we have to do something to check for aliasing for snippet A? The answer is no, because we're, between A and B? Yes, we'd have to worry about aliasing between A and B. That is potentially an issue. But we'd also have to worry about that in snippet B in the same kind of way. And most likely, when vectorizing this, we do just make sure they don't overlap, basically. Do the serial version if they overlap. Other questions? Yeah. Question five, okay. So question five here, we have these two versions, and version one is problematic because at index I equals one, we need the result from I equals 0. Because when I equals 1, we're using A of 1 is being assigned based on A of 0, which was set when I equals 0. So we need the result of the previous iteration to compute the result in the next iteration. But when we vectorize this, what we want to do is we want to compute I equals 0 and I equals 1 at the same time. But we can't actually do that because of the dependencies between them. So that's going to make vectorizing this a lot less straightforward. For the second one, A of I plus 1, that's going to have its initial value when we need it. So what we can do is we can load A1 through, say, A9, or A8. Yeah, A1 through A8, and load A0 through A7, add them together, store them in A0 through A7. We don't have any type of conflict like that. other questions, follow-ups back there?
For question one.
Yes. So the question is, for question one, why is it okay to unroll the loop without worrying about aliasing, but not okay to swap the I and J loops? So when we unroll the loop, what we'll do is we'll copy this loop body here, and we'll just basically find and replace J with J plus one. When we do that, if there's aliasing, it's still going to work because we're going to be rereading and rewriting each element of C and A and B each time the same way we would have in the original. So there's no actual aliasing concerns. Now, you might make the observation, wait a moment, wouldn't it be really nice to have C of I in a register? That would be great. Wouldn't we want to do something like that? And the answer is yes, that would be great. We want to do that. That's not unrolled. That is something we want to do, and that's an optimization that alias isn't going to hinder, but that's not part of unrolling. And that's something we could do on this loop as is, because we could, you know, add some code to load CFI here and to store it here, keeping it in a register in the meanwhile. As for swapping the I and J loops, so we can't do that because if we have aliasing, then the CFI might write one of these A values, because they might be parts of the same array. And when we swap the loops, we might change when we read back the value that was written. We might change what I's and J's that happens for. And that would be a problem for getting the same answer, which would be meaning the compiler couldn't just do that automatically. Okay. Follow-ups, other questions? Yes. So the question, isn't there aliasing for both? Yes, there are cases where we have two things with different names that are the same thing. But what matters is where we have dependencies. In the case of B, we can easily deal with that because we know that in future iterations... For four, isn't there aliasing for both? Yes, there's aliasing for both. And I think the aliasing, it would be something we'd have to check for both. But it's the same check for both, essentially. Or a very similar check. So it's slightly more complicated for this because, it's probably not really more complicated because here we have to worry about, we still have to worry about what's A of I, right, here. Yeah, so it's basically the same check for both, would be my argument. So why is it more simple for A? Because we can load the elements. So if we detect that A and B don't overlap, we can load the elements of B for A into vectors in the sets we want. We can load, just a set of 8 elements of B that are contiguous, and those will be the elements we want, if we have vectors of size 8. If we try to do the same thing for snippet B, well, the 8 elements of B we'd want for 8 consecutive iterations of the loop, they could be anywhere, and we don't have a good load instruction for that. Other questions? Yes.
I think it's question 2 mentions the instruction cache. Is the way the instruction cache set up, is it just a list of instructions that need to be executed in a row, something to that effect?
So the question is, for question 2, is the instruction cache just a list of instructions that need to be executed in a row? The instruction cache is a cache that works like the caches we know, but when do we read something from it? When we're fetching an instruction. So instruction cache accesses are instruction fetches. Other questions? So those instruction cache accesses are just how many times do we fetch an instruction? Other questions, comments? Okay. So, yes, mentioning about vector instructions. So we saw the vector instructions that sort of, you know, features that were commonly implemented processors and other things you might want. And as I mentioned, these things are actually from the 90s. So in the 90s, there were a bunch of supercomputers that were designed around vector instructions. And basically, Intel and ARM and everyone else has been adding these features to modern processors that were invented in the 90s as new hot features. And fancier things, we haven't talked about how they would work, but I just want you to know that these things exist, and they're implemented on some of the more recent versions of vector instructions on like desktop and laptop processors, and on GPUs, they're very much implemented, are better ways of handling conditionals. So, like, so far, handling a conditional loop seems really awkward. There are ways of doing that. Handling variable length vectors. So the vector instructions we saw so far, it's kind of weird if you have, like, five left over. There are sort of designs which try to make that be better supported by the hardware and being able to load and store non-contiguous values, which typically just involves meaning the hardware needs some way of like giving a list of addresses to load and somehow loading them efficiently, or at least as efficiently as possible. Also like to mention that these intrinsics we've used aren't the only interface for vector programming. So there's some sort of other proposals. So for example, GCC has some vector extensions that look more like normal C code, where like they have a type for each kind of vector and assign make plus work the correct way in theory. I don't teach them partly because they're less well documented and partly because I just don't know if the compiler does well with them. And GPU programming looks very different from what we've done, though the hardware might be more similar. In GPUs, you typically do something that looks like writing multi-threaded code, like the same sort of way you'd write code that runs in multiple cores, except each thing you'd run that looks like it would run in a separate core actually is a different lane of each vector, including the way the GPU handles things like conditionals and so on works with that. The compiler for CUDA handles all that sort of stuff, or other things that are like CUDA. Okay, so that's about vectorization. So questions before I go on to our last optimization topic? Yes? So question, can I say what I mean by vector lane? By a vector lane, I mean one of the elements of our vector. So if we have 8 elements in each of our vectors, that we have 8 lanes.
Okay.
And this terminology varies. I'm going to try to use the term lane. If you read things about GPUs, they'll often say, oh, we have 10,000 threads. They often mean lanes. What I'll call lanes, and what no general desktop processor would call threads. Okay. Other questions, comments? Okay. So one last thing about optimization. So we have these optimization assignments where, you know, we just like tell you, make this function faster. This is not how the real world optimization problems look. So what you should you do if you have a real program, and you're at a job, and someone tells you to make it faster? So my recommendation, first, make sure you're asking your compiler to try. Like, compilers often don't like actually make things as fast as they can by default, and that will probably save you a bunch of time if that just works. If not, make sure you're spending the effort where it matters. If you spend a ton of time optimizing the calculations your program does, and it turns out your program is spending 90% of its time parsing its input in text files, you know, you have not made that program substantially faster, even if, you know, you made that calculation way better. So you want to discover, you know, if all your time is spent in one routine, so you optimize that routine and not something else. Because it's very common for programmers, full source, to have the wrong intuition about why their program is slow. And there are tools to help you with this called profilers. These are tools which you run your program in them, and they tell you where your program spends its time. So in Linux, one example of this is a program called perf, P-E-R-F. And the way perf works is that you run your program under perf, and it periodically stops your program and gets a stack trace. So just as if you stopped in the debugger and looked at the call stack. So it gets a whole bunch of those samples, and it consolidates them together to say, you know, X percent of the time you were in this function, and that can give you an idea, assuming you run it on something that's representative of where your time spends. So as an example, here's some of the output of perf on HTLRS. I ran HTLRS for a lot of cycles on a single input and measured where the time was spent. So why does it not, is it not super fast? And this is sort of the a screenshot of the data browser that perf gave me. And we have a list of functions here. And we have these two columns, children and self. So the children column is the percent of time that when it took that stack trace, it included that function somewhere. So for example, main has 100% in that column because every time it took a sample, main was running. Now, we weren't actually in the main function itself. We were usually in something main called. And that's why the self time for main is zero. We were never, when we took those samples, main wasn't actually the function currently running. It was just something that main called that was running. So the self time is when we took a sample, when were we actually in that function versus in something it was calling. And if we look at this, so we see like, that, oh, yeah, we were in main, that makes sense. We were in this running program classes run method. You know, that's not surprising. We're spending a lot of time in this expression evaluate function. So you can see that we're spending 30% of the samples were in that function itself, and another 30%, to give us our total, were in that something that function called. And we had this sort of surprising discovery that when we look further down here, a lot of the time we're spending is in functions related to our hash maps. We have this make hash function, which is a hashing function for that hash map. We have the get function of the hash map, which is, you know, 10% of our time is spent there. And these two hashing functions seem to account for like 40% of our time. So the discovery I made here is that if I want to optimize HTLRS to be faster running for a long time, what I should be concerned about is that I'm spending a lot of time doing hash map lookups. Maybe I should try to choose something more efficient where I don't have to recompute my hash function over and over again. And that is not something I would have guessed by just reading the code. Questions about our profiler output. So that's where I'll conclude on optimization. So yeah, if you're actually optimizing, use something like a profiler so you don't spend your time fixing the thing which isn't actually the slow part. Okay, so next we're going to go on to a different topic. So let's say here I have this infinite loop here. So this is just a program that runs a while loop forever. Now let's say I run this on a shared department machine. So I SSH into portal, I compile this program and start it. So first question, if I do this, can you use that machine? Who says yes? That machine's going to be usable for you by you. Who says, no, that machine's not going to be usable? OK. And we didn't even get to the second part if the machine only had one core. Now, the answer is, in fact, that the machine would be usable to you. And that's not intuitive, because if we think of what this program does, it seems like it's going to, when it starts running, it's going to keep running forever. So how could the machine, the shared machine, still be usable to you? What's going to do that? And this is something about how the OS is going to run on that machine, and how the hardware is going to help the OS run, so the OS can enforce things like making that shared machine still usable, even though I'm running this infinite loop that I think is running forever. And to see this, you can try a variation on that infinite loop. So here I have, it's a finite loop, but I'm timing just doing nothing. So I'm getting a timestamp, getting another timestamp. And what we'd expect is that after our caches are all set up, that we get the same number each time, right? That it's the same amount of time from when this call to get time finishes to when this call to get time finishes. You know, the only thing that could cause problems are like cache misses, but after this loop runs for a bit, we won't have any of those. So that's what we expect. But here's a graph of the actual outputs I got. Note that this is a log scale. So typically, the time difference I measured was about 20 nanoseconds. But sometimes it got all the way up to like 10 or 20 milliseconds. So what was happening when we had these big amounts of time? And a big part of this is that, well, I was measuring this on a system where other things were also running. And the mechanism by which the other things also ran is that they were sharing our physical processor with that. So from the perspective of my timing program calls get time and calls it again, and nothing happens in between as far as it's concerned. But in practice, you know, we'd have this big delay. So there's this like million cycle delay here. And during that million cycle delay, somehow other programs get to run. So somehow my system is set up so there's other programs that were also competing for my system, and then my SSH client, my web browser, got some time to use the CPU and run in that gap. And from the perspective of my loop program, it was just a slow move instruction there. That move of RAX to RBP took a million cycles, apparently. So what was really happening to make this happen? Well, we needed to have some way that the hardware could decide that instead of keeping running this loop, it would run something else. And that has to cooperate with the operating system. And the mechanism by which the hardware does this is called an exception. So these exceptions are different than the exceptions you learned in Java or so on. These are completely different type of exception, even though, yes, they have the same name. So an exception is a mechanism by which the hardware will start the operating system in the middle of something else. So our program thinks it owns the CPU to itself, our loop. It acts as if I just have the whole CPU. But what actually happens is our hardware decides to run the operating system in the middle with this exception mechanism. And the operating system gets to run and decides what to do. And what it decided in this case is that, oh, well, this loop program, it's run for too long. That's not very nice. I'm going to run something else. And this SSH program looks like it could run right now. Let's run it. And eventually decides, oh, I haven't run the loop program for a while. Let that run for a little bit more. Some questions about this time multiplexing idea. So it's called time multiplexing because we're sharing our single core over time. We're dividing up the time among our different programs. Yes? So the question is, what triggers the exception? So there are lots of possibilities, and we'll have a whole taxonomy of them later. Other questions? Okay, so this time multiplexing, so what happens here is that the OS somehow starts running, so the hardware mechanism is this exceptions, and the OS, well, it needs to switch between two programs. So how is it going to do that? Well, it's going to save the state of our loop program. So in order to keep running our loop program as if nothing happened, the OS needs to save the program counter, so it needs to know where to jump back to in the loop program. And it also needs to save all its registers. Why all its registers? Because, well, when we go back to running it later on, We need to act as if nothing happened. We need to have, you know, RBP and RAX have all the same values, and the stack pointer and so on, have all the same values they had when we interrupted the program earlier. And then we need to run our other program. So we're going to restore its registers and jump to its program counter. And this is something we probably saved earlier when that program was stopped in a similar way. And this whole process is called a context switch. So the information we save about a program, its program counter and registers, we call that its context. So we're switching from one program's context to another. And our context is going to include all those register values. It's going to include any other state that's visible on the CPU. So one thing we have to save that might not be obvious is we have to save all the condition codes. Because let's say I stop the loop program, that exception happens, just before it has a conditional jump. When I jump back to that conditional jump later on, it better have the right outcome, which means I have to save the condition codes to make that happen and restore them before I restart the loop program. And also the program. So when we do this sort of context switching, the loop program kind of has the impression that it owns the whole CPU, even though it's really sharing it. Because from its perspective, it's written as if it's just written for one core and it occupies it the whole time, even though we know that's not really what's happening. And to implement this, the OS is just going to have some code where it, you know, takes all our registers in our program counter, stores them somewhere, and restores some previously saved values, and then jumps back to some other program. Or visually, we can say that the CPU like holds a context for one program, holds all its registers, including pointers to its memory. And the OS has a saved copy of another program, and basically they're just going to change places. They're going to swap the two in order to do this context switch. Some questions about our context switch operation? Yes. So the question is, if I could measure like the time the loop's instructions were measured executing, would I have a more accurate time? So what do you mean by accurate?
Would you avoid including the time that it took to execute SSH and Firefox?
So the question is, could I have a timer which like doesn't include that time? Yes, probably to get that I need some help from the operating system, but that might be provided. I think if you had that, you still wouldn't see a sort of constant time between the two get times, because one of the effects of switching from loop to SSH is that we're going to evict some things from the cache that loop wanted in the cache. Does that answer?
So the context is just the values in registers, not?
So the context is just the values that are visible. Yes, and visible directly. So we don't include things that are less directly visible, like whether something's in the cache or not. Because what we care about is, will we run the instructions according to how our manual says the instructions should work? Not, are we going to run them with the exact same efficiency and so on? Other questions about our context switch? Okay, so we've talked about sharing our processor core, and we should also talk about memory. And let's say I have one program where I have a global variable that I've initialized to 42, and I've placed it statically at address 10,000 hex. So in this program, I have my variable 42, and I load it into RAX. somewhere. And let's say while that's running, there's a program B that's going to try to interfere with this, that some nasty person has said, oh, let me mess up program A by writing 99 to that same memory address. So let's say I did this on Portal. What would you expect to happen if I ran these two programs at the same time on Portal? In particular, what would you expect the values of RAX from program A to be? Run this at the same time on Portal, or you know, maybe on your desk, your laptop, or something like that. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, the result's always 42, unconditionally? Okay. B, it's always 99. C, D, it's 42 or 99, depending, okay. E, it's 42 or there's a crash. F, it's 99 or there's a crash. Or G, it's 42 or 99 or maybe things crash. Okay, some people for that. Something else? Okay, so we're spread out, but most people think, oh, well, it looks like, based on what I showed you, that, you know, that if program, you know, B has a, you know, pointer to process A's memory location, it's going to be able to do stuff to it. That looks possible. And in fact, what's true on real systems is that RAX is always 42, and program B might end up crashing. But to make this happen, clearly context switches need to be a little more complicated than I showed you. And you say, hey, why is this the result, you know, we would want? So I would assert that this is better than the result of possibly being 99, because typically when we write a program, we want to not be able to think about what are the other programs going to do. We want each program to be independent by default, and this is the abstraction that modern operating systems provide. So we certainly could make it, and it would be simpler to have a system where the result would be 99, but that's not the design we have, because we want you to have the convenience of thinking that when I write a program, I only need to worry about what my program does to memory, not what all the other programs are doing. And we provide this abstraction that each program sort of has its own view of memory with separate data. And this means that depending on where that address 10,000 is, so let's say it's here in program A, well, in that case, there's a 10,000 in program B, but it's something else. It's some other value. And there might be a crash if writing to that value is problematic, might not. Or maybe, 10,000 would be a valid address in, program A and not in program B, and we'd end up with a crash. Now, to make this happen, we need to do something. And one thing you might say is, well, if we want them to have independent values, the simplest solution would be that we need to copy the memory around, like save a copy of the memory somewhere when we context switch. But that's not practical because, saving all the registers is already not super efficient. Saving all the memory is going to be real slow. And remember that we're doing things where we want to switch to a program for like a few milliseconds. If we have to copy like a couple megabytes of memory to do that, that's not good. So instead, the hardware is going to help us out implementing this idea that each of the program has its own picture of memory. And it's going to do this with this abstraction we'll call an address space. And the implementation of that is the OS is going to set this mapping between the addresses the program sees and the real memory. And typically, the OS is going to set a mapping where two programs, you know, by default, aren't going to have any addresses that map to the same place. So there's no way program B can write to anything that program A is going to read by default. So questions about this mapping idea? So, and this mapping, that's something we're going to have to change in our context, which is in addition to all the register values. So to make this work, we're going to need to, you know, change not only all the registers in the program counter, we're going to change the mapping to the new program's mapping so we can run it. Now, something about these mappings that showed up is that we have these holes in these mappings. We have these regions that I sort of X'd out. And these are regions where if you try to access them in your normal program, your program ends up crashing. So how is that going to work? Well, our mapping needs to be a little more complicated. In addition to mapping from an address to a memory location in the real memory, it can also map to, say, trigger an error processor. And when the program tries to access an address that maps to trigger an error, instead of running that load or store instruction, the processor will run the OS with this exception mechanism and tell the OS to figure out what to do. And the most common thing we've seen the OSs do is crash the program in a way which ends up resulting in segmentation fault being printed somewhere, or possibly bus error being printed somewhere. Yes? Yes.
In reality, there's no overlap between the code boxes of program A and B.
The question is, in this diagram, we have the two memories side by side. There's no actual overlap. Yes, and that's because most likely, you know, the sort of default way the OS would set that up is that they'd set up these mappings such that none of them point to the same place. Now, the OS doesn't have to do that, and there are in practice some exceptions, including some which are a little bit common, but sort of our default policy is that they don't overlap. But the OS gets to make all that decision because the OS sets those mappings. Yes?
Two questions. One, is the error triggered if an address is called that's outside of the program's address space?
So question is the error triggered if the address is called that's outside the program's address space? We usually call addresses that trigger it outside their address space as a sort of a definition of what outside the address space means.
Okay.
Yes?
So does that mean that there's some decision when the program is run about how much space needs to be put into its address space for it to function properly?
So question, is there a decision about how much space we allocate to a program when a program is run? Yes. And the way the OS makes that decision is by how many valid arrows it puts in the mapping. So if the OS sets a mapping where only 4 kilobytes are mapped, the program only has 4 kilobytes. If it sets a mapping where 1 megabyte of addresses are mapped, the program has 1 megabyte. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so you're just saying the OS makes that decision by evaluating the program in some way.
Question, is the OS makes that decision by evaluating the program in some way? Yes. And for example, like if you think of malloc, one of the things malloc does sometimes is it might sometimes ask the OS to please allocate me more space, in which case the OS will change the mapping to do that. Other questions? Comments?
Did you say that the
Question, did I say the mapping is stored when I context switch? The mapping is changed when I context switch. So how the mapping is stored is a good question, and how fast it is to change. We're not going to talk about that yet. The mechanism that modern processors use to implement this mapping is called virtual memory, and the mapping is stored using a data structure called page tables. And we're going to talk about that in lots of detail, but not today. Question? Okay. So our context includes our registers, our condition codes, our program counter, and a representation of our address space in some way. And we'll talk about exactly how that's represented over the next couple weeks. So when we put our two mechanisms together, when we have our time multiplexing and this address space, we get this abstraction we call a process. So a process has what I call threads. And a thread is this illusion of your own CPU. So that's what we get when we share the CPU with time multiplexing, that we write programs as if they get the whole CPU to themselves, even though we know that's not really what happens. And we also write programs as if they get the whole memory to themselves, even though we actually have this address space abstraction to make that possible, even though we're sharing the memory with lots of programs. And basically, when we combine that, we run these processes, which kind of get this idea that they have this whole machine to themselves with one or more cores and a memory dedicated to themselves, even though the machine's actually shared with lots of other programs, you know, and which are sharing the same CPU and the same memory, or same cores and the same memory. And this is sort of the main job of an operating system, is implementing this process abstraction. And we're going to talk in this course about what the hardware does to allow that to happen. And we're going to talk about, to do that, talk about exceptions, which are going to be our primary way of being able to implement threads, and also virtual memory, which is, as I mentioned, the way that address spaces are going to be implemented. So let's talk a bit about exceptions. So I mentioned, promised earlier, that we'd have a whole taxonomy of causes of exceptions. Here it is. So there's two major categories of things that trigger exceptions. This is our textbook's names. There are some which are asynchronous, meaning that they aren't triggered by the running program. So in the case of our loop program, there's nothing that program did that should cause an exception itself. So if an exception happened, something else happened. We had typically an interrupt, some externally triggered event. And most likely, the externally triggered event would have been a timer interrupt. So processors typically have a timer device that's usually built into the same package that can be programmed by the operating system that will periodically send a signal to the CPU, and the CPU will then trigger an exception and run the operating system regardless of what else is running. So typically, an operating system will configure this timer before starting a program to run it later, so it can guarantee that if I run this program that might have an infinite loop, I'll get to run and stop it and run something else, regardless of what happens. Another source of externally triggered exceptions is I/O devices. So like if I press a key on the keyboard, we'd like the OS to record that key press and to send it to whatever program is supposed to be getting the key presses, which the OS is going to be responsible for knowing. And potentially, the OS might decide that that's a good time to switch from whatever's running to whatever program might use the key press. And to make that happen, something else needed to happen. So if I ask to read a key from the keyboard, I need to somehow inform the OS that I'm interested in key presses. So the OS knows that it should send them to me. Also, typically when I read from the keyboard, I want my program to stop running while I'm doing that. I want to wait for a key press. So we need some mechanism of asking the OS to do something. And you might say, can't we just make a function call? And it's going to turn out, for reasons we'll discuss probably next time, that that's not going to be good enough. So the way we're going to ask the OS to do things on our program's behalf is with one of these synchronous exceptions, something that's triggered by something the program does. And we're going to have one category of intentionally triggered exceptions. So when I want to read a key from the keyboard, I'm going to like call this read function in my program, and that library function's going to intentionally trigger an exception to run the OS and tell the OS that I want it to do something on my behalf. And this is called a system call. And what I want to do on its behalf is I want you to get a key from the keyboard and stop running me until I have one ready. So if I have my read input program, so I'll make this intentional exception, or rather, most likely, the read a key press function I call will do that on my behalf, which will run the OS, and the OS will say, okay, read input.exe, it wants to wait until there's a key press, I'll remember that for later. And then sometime later, the key press will happen, and it will trigger an interrupt. So whatever this Burple program was will be stopped, and the OS will run, and it can figure out, oh, there's a key press. Oh, earlier I promised this other program I'd run it when there was a key press. Let's do that now. So questions about this timeline here? Okay, so we've seen sort of our externally triggered events, our timers, and our I/O devices, like key presses. We've seen this notion of traps that we'd intentionally trigger an exception as our mechanism of making requests to the OS. Sort of instead of making a normal function call, we'll use this mechanism to ask the OS to do something on our behalf. And there's this last category of exceptions triggered by the current program called faults. And these are errors or events in programs. So one of these is that this is what that trigger error in our memory mapping is. So if a program accesses memory that's not part of its mapping, the processor is going to run the OS and ask the OS what you want to do. And the OS can decide to do whatever it wants, of course. It's its code. So it could decide to crash the program. It could decide to try to change the mapping. It has options. We'll talk about privileged instructions later. If there's a divide by zero, that's another example. The processor doesn't know what to do, so it asks the OS, hey, this program divided by zero, what do you want to do about it? And the OS could crash the program, it could run a debugger, it has, it gets to decide. This is a way that the hardware, can handle the programs doing these weird things without crashing the whole machine. And the same applies for invalid instructions. If a program runs an instruction the hardware doesn't understand, it's not going to crash the whole machine, it's going to tell the OS, hey, this program ran an instruction I don't know, why don't you decide what to do about it? And these are called faults. So these are not cases where it's intentionally triggered, but it is because something that the program did. We can point to an instruction and say, that instruction caused this event. Yes?
So when you say it's not intentionally triggered, if we have, if we write an exception, Java or Python, we write our own exception for certain things that throws an error in the program, would that be considered a fault or is that?
So the question is, how do Java exceptions or C++ exceptions relate to this? They are a completely different thing. They share the same name, and they are also used to handle errors, but otherwise, the implementation is very different. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about how our hardware exceptions are going to be implemented in both the hardware and the operating system. So in the hardware, we're going to need some way to detect all these conditions that can trigger exceptions. And when that happens, we need to stop what we're running now, and we need to save some information. At minimum, the hardware needs to save the current program counter. Why? Because we're going to run the OS. To run the OS, we need to set the program counter to point to the OS. If we do that without saving the old program counter, we're going to forget it, and then I can't go back to that loop that I was running in the right place. I don't know where I stopped. So once we save that, then we can jump to what we'll call the exception handler, which is the part of the OS that's going to be handling this particular exception. This is going to be done without a program instruction to do so. So I'm going to talk about sort of details of this process. I would note that I, in our textbook, describe a simplified version compared to what happens on real x86 systems. So there's some variety between architectures and how exceptions are handled. And x86, if you look at how it really works, is unusually complicated. So we're going to show this very simplified version that ignores most of those complications, because most of those complications exist because of a long and storied history of the x86 design that is mostly irrelevant to, you know, understanding how exceptions work. So one thing we have to do is we have to figure out where the exception handler is. So a mechanism we can use to do that is that we can have some special register in the processor, which we'll call an exception table base register, that points to an array of where the exception handlers are. And typically, we'll have different exception handlers for each kind of exception. So like we'll have one for divide by zero, one for timer interrupts, and so on. So the OS will make a table of all its handlers. And at boot, it will run a special instruction to set this special register to point to that table. And then after that setup at boot, whenever a program's running and a divide by zero happens, it will jump to the divide by zero handler by looking up the first entry in this table, in our example here. And for any other type of exception, it will just have an index that's chosen in advance to look up and jump there. Some questions about this exception table? Okay, so we know how we find the exception. And once the hardware is running the OS can do all the other work. So what did we add to the hardware? Let's first look at that before we start talking about what is the OS typically going to do in an exception handler. So we need a new instruction to set that special register, that exception table base pointer. We need logic to jump based on the exception table. That's maybe not something we really need for any other instruction. We need logic to save the old program counter, and commonly, processors will save a little bit more. So for example, x86 also saves the stack pointer. But at a minimum, we need to save the old program counter. And we need some place to save it. So we could save it to a special register, that's a common choice, or we could save it to some memory location that maybe the OS specifies somehow, or that's just fixed. And then we're going to need a new instruction to return from an exception. So maybe we could deal without this, but it's going to be tricky to not have some special instruction for this. One reason why is that we'd really like to return from an exception without, do a jump to return from an exception without needing to worry about having the place we're jumping to stored in any register, because we have to set all the registers to what the program expects. There's going to be a more fundamental reason why we're going to want a special return from exception instruction that we'll talk to when we talk about security issues. Okay. So what are we going to run here? So we'll have our exception handler. And typically, the way operating systems will write their exception handlers is that the first thing almost every exception handler will do is it will save the process's state. So it will save a bunch of registers somewhere. Then we'll do the work to handle the exception. So if it's divided by zero, we'll probably work on crashing the program or telling the debugger about it. If it's a system call, we'll figure out what does the program want us to do, remember that. If it's a timer interrupt, we'll figure out what program do I really want to run now. Then we're going to restore a process's state. If we want to keep running the same program, so like if the program like made a system call to like output something to the terminal, then maybe we want to keep running it, then we'll restore the same process state that we saved earlier. Otherwise, we'll restore a different process state. And then we'll jump back to the program, where the program might be a different program now if we decided to do a context switch. So questions about this structure? Yes.
In practice, for step one, saving the program state, does the processor just like squash everything that's in it after that, like after it stores the registers and other relevant values?
So the question, your question is, how does this interact with the processor having other instructions in flight when the exception happens?
Yeah.
So the processor is responsible for making it as if we ran all the instructions before up to something and nothing afterwards. So the way the processor, I have incredibly detailed slides on this. So one way you could handle this is that in the, we mentioned the commit stage, right? So the commit stage is generally responsible for this. And one way we can handle this is we'll have a reorder buffer, which is just an ordered list of the instructions where we keep track of whether the instruction finished. And as all the instructions up to some number have finished, we'll update a register mapping for completed instructions. And when an exception happens, so let's say here instruction 20 had an exception, we'll let every instruction before it finish, and then we'll copy the register mapping from after instruction 20 to our physical register. So that's one implementation technique. Note this would also work for branch mispredictions. We can handle branch mispredictions in the same way if we want to. So the strategy is basically that we did, like, as instructions finish, we track the same way we did for register renaming, the current mapping of registers, and then what we can just go up to a certain instruction, restore that mapping, and then we can, you know, discard all the registers we're not using. And hopefully stop any instructions in progress that we don't care about. So that's one way we could implement this. There's some other techniques in the literature, but this is probably one of the easier ones to explain in terms of how we explain how out-of-order processors worked. Questions on that? I'll say I'm not planning on testing this, but since I did not cover this in the morning lecture and don't expect to. But this is sort of the basic strategy, and this is the big reason why we have a commit stage. That's why we have that separate pipeline stage, is so we can do things like when an exception happens, when there's a divide by zero, we can stop the program at the right time for the debugger. Other questions? Yes. So which program are we jumping to? Whatever one whose state we restore. So sometimes the same one, sometimes a different one. Other questions? So sort of our high-level view is that we'll have our timer interrupt, you know, in our original example. So we see that the reason that this actually ended up switching to SSH is that when we did that restore operation, we decided to restore not loop.exe's registers, we decided to restore SSH's. And that was just a decision the OS's code made. Presumably because it had some policy which said that, oh, if a program runs for more than too many milliseconds, please run something else. If something else can run. If you take operating systems, we'll talk a lot more about the sort of decisions the OS could make. We're going to talk just about the hardware mechanisms to support whatever decision the OS might want to make. So in this example, you might say, okay, you know, we have this loop program here, you know, and if this was like an infinite loop, this would run indefinitely, but we'd switch away from it. Maybe, you know, if I really want to hog portal and want to make it actually unusable, going back to our original question, right? I told you, you said, wouldn't this make portal unusable? I said, no, it wouldn't. I'd say, well, here's our problem. Our problem is that this timer interrupt handler gets run, and the silly operating system author decided that the timer interrupt handler should run a different program. So let's fix that. You know, why don't we write a program where we fix the exception table to have our better version, where we're just going to return back to the same program, not run anything else. So why can't we do this? And, well, we, at least we hope we can't do this, and it turns out we can't. So if I write a program to do this, so the x86 instruction to set the exception table is called LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. If I run this program with a properly set up exception table, I get a segmentation fault, meaning that some sort of fault happened, and kind of like accessing something out of bounds of memory, and the operating system got that in its exception handler before I could set a new one, and decided that it was going to crash my program. So why was that possible? So we'll talk about this. I'm going to just say sync with the other section. We'll stop here. But the basic idea is that there's going to be some privileged instructions that only the OS can run. And when you're not in the OS, we're going to make it so that they trigger an exception instead. And one of the examples of this is going to be setting a new exception table. And that's good, because I can't write this evil program that's going to hog all the CPU time on Portal by making it so the OS doesn't switch away from me. I'm not going to be allowed to do that. When I try, it's going to tell the OS, hey, this program tried to set a new exception table. What do you want to do about it? And the OS, in this case, decided we're just going to crash it. So that's where I'll finish up today. We'll talk about the mechanism behind privileged instructions next time and start on virtual memory.